Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am the Projectionist, your co-host for this radio program. Now, come join your host, Vic Sage, as we enter the vault to once again discuss retro horror films and television programs. That was a rather impressive turnout, Victor.
Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is a book series that a lot of us that work in the vault grew up with. So, when you managed to snag a print to screen here, how could any of us resist?
I'm glad my contacts were able to provide a print. That reminds me, I'll need to call intern Rockford J and ask him to return the film reels tomorrow morning.
I think it's his day off, Projectionist. Besides, how did you get your hands on a film print of it? I thought most new films were digital these days.
As I have mentioned, Sage, I have my ways. As for intern Rockford J being off, there are no days off for interns. That is how you get ahead in business, dear boy.
And I've told you 100 times before, Rockford J isn't an intern. At least not anymore. I'm pretty sure I can see memos from the Vault HR department on your desk here. Wow, lots of memos.
You should mind your own business, you dolt. Look, there on the control panel, the recording light is on. It is time, once again, to entertain our dear and loyal listeners with a new Saturday Frights radio show, eh?
Hey there, listeners! Welcome to a new Saturday Frights podcast matinee episode. This will be our spoiler-free review of the just-released Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, directed by Andre Ovredal and produced by Guillermo del Toro. Obviously based on the somewhat controversial trilogy of scary storybooks by Alvin Schwartz that contained those very memorable illustrations by Stephen Gammell.
Controversial, you say? How so?
I believe that the ALA, the American Library Association, claimed that the Scary Stories series was the most challenged series of books in the 90s. It apparently was the 7th on that list from the 2000s. The late Alvin Schwartz, in case you aren't aware, collected folk tales and urban legends from around the world, the type you would share surrounded by the glow of a campfire. Jump stories, like those that you would tell each other if you were having a sleepover. Stories like The Golden Arm. Collections meant for younger readers and those young at heart. Due to the nature of the stories, the dead returning for revenge or justice, cannibalism, and so on, some parent groups felt they weren't appropriate for young readers. Which is funny, because many of the poems or songs featured in the collections were the very same tunes, focusing on death and such, that we sang in grade school around Halloween, for our fellow classmates and in pageants. Yet, like I said, there were more than a few that objected to the books being made available to their children.
Of course they did.
Perhaps the books would have been overlooked. They were, as I mentioned, designed for younger readers, if they hadn't had the beautiful, if sometimes disturbing, black and white illustrations of Stephen Gammell. I mean, in the first book, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which was released in 1981, on page 30, there is a full-page image of a dead girl. Empty sockets where her eyes should be, and her flesh looks doughy and is peeling away. Schwartz did a remarkable job of collecting these stories, and Stephen Gammell's artwork is unique and alluring. Each, on their own, is amazing. But when Harper Publishing wisely decided to pair the two up, they helped create something quite magical, and a collection of stories that has managed to entertain as well as frighten and educate its readers since 1981. Obviously, it's still thought of fondly enough that a film adaptation was made.
I take it you were one of those young ones that was frightened by these books.
No, not really. I loved them. But I was in junior high school when the school library got in Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And since this was by 1984, Schwartz and Gammell had released more Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And while none of the campfire tales collected by Schwartz actually scared me, I definitely remember a few of them being delightfully creepy to read and reread. Actually, thanks to Gammell's illustrations and the fact that I would read some of the stories, the more appropriate ones, to younger kids on the school bus on the way home, it helped to plant the seed of my love of storytelling, as well as crafting some incredibly fond memories from my teenage years. Especially since I've shared on the Retroist and other podcasts that until high school, due to being excessively bullied, going to school wasn't always that enjoyable.
So your junior high school wasn't pressured to remove the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark series?
Not at all. This was the same library that got all those excellent Time Life Mysteries of the Unknown books, another important book series that I look back on fondly. Okay, I think we need to jump into our review of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. We'll keep it mostly non-spoiler, as much as we can, sticking to what can be figured out from the trailers. We'll do that right after a little break. Projectionist, I believe you have one of the movie's trailers threaded up for the listeners to enjoy?
Indeed I do, Sage. Indeed I do.
This town has told stories about me. Horrible stories. But they don't realize I have scary stories of my own.
Cerebellos. Tell me a story.
Sarah Bellows' book, when the stories write themselves, it all comes alive.
You don't read the book. The book reads you.
I'm afraid I'm gonna die, Dad.
Next. Next.
Front, I'm going to say that Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark mostly hits the mark in my mind. It is a film that is meant to harken back a little to the Steven Spielberg produced and directed Amblin Pictures of the 80s. But, as both director Andre Ofredal, as well as producer Guillermo del Toro have pointed out, instead of adventure and science fiction, they wanted this movie to possibly be the gateway to horror films for a younger audience. Hence, the PG-13 rating, of course.
For PG-13 picture, you most assuredly jumped in a few spots in the film, Victor.
Oh, yeah, I have no problem admitting that at all. There are some incredibly effective jump scares in the movie, which shouldn't be surprising, considering that Andre not only wrote and directed 2010's excellent Troll Hunter, but also directed 2016's stunning and quite terrifying, The Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Ah, yes. I quite enjoyed that particular film, dear listeners.
If you've not seen it for yourself, I believe The Autopsy of Jane Doe is available on Netflix at the time of this recording. Now, obviously, your mileage may vary on what you consider to be scary. Overall, I say that with the incredible practical effects, which masterfully bring to life some of Stephen Gammell's illustrations, such as the corpse of that young girl I mentioned earlier, the chills hit the mark. While Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is more creepy than outright scary, there are still some moments where you might think to yourself, this is PG-13?
What I found most curious was that the picture was not an anthology, such as the book series.
Both Andre and Guillermo addressed that, my friend. It isn't like they didn't think about going that route, of course, but they felt that an anthology film is only as good as its weakest offering. Like I mentioned a moment ago, with the feeling of the movie they were shooting for being a throwback to the films that Amblin made, it sounds like they felt it would be best if the movie itself focused on the characters. More importantly, making them relatable, even though this is a period film. It takes place in the autumn of 1968, in the little town of Mill Valley in Pennsylvania. As the film begins, it takes place on Halloween night, actually. This is where we are introduced to our handful of main characters. Stella Nichols, arguably the main protagonist, wonderfully played by Zoe Margaret Coletti. August Augie Hildebrand, portrayed by Gabriel Rush. Austin Zadger plays the wisecracking Chuck Steinberg, with his sister Ruth being portrayed by Natalie Gonsorn. And Mill Valley's local bully, Tommy, played by Austin Abrams. And last but not least, a newcomer to the town, Ramon Morales, who is played by Michael Garza.
A most interesting time period to set the film, wouldn't you say, Victor?
Yeah. Well, with the turmoil in America at the time with Vietnam and other elements that are focused on in the film, and sadly we still suffer from today, making scary stories to tell in the dark a period piece works better in my opinion. For one thing, it cuts out the ability of the main characters to communicate with each other. If it was set in modern day, they'd have cell phones and such. After our introduction of the main group of core characters, which results in Stella, Chuck, and Augie hiding out in Ramon's car at the local drive-in,
I was tickled to see that the drive-in was playing a double feature, dear listeners. Two films I'm sure you are quite familiar with. 1963's The Terror, with Boris Karloff, Sandra Knight, Dick Miller, and Jack Nicholson. In addition to 1968's Night of the Living Dead.
We should point out that Stella, besides being an inspiring writer, is most definitely a monster kid, as the posters and lobby cards that decorate her bedroom point out. Stella and her friends are trying to avoid the wrath of an incredibly drunk and angry Tommy, who was a victim of one of Chuck's practical jokes. When the coast is clear, we not only learn what makes Stella, Chuck, and Augie tick, but we find out that Mill Valley has a pretty dark local legend. Which is how the young woman invites Ramon to go check out a supposed haunted house.
Yes, the home of one Sarah Bellows, a member of one of the founding families of Mill Valley. A family member that was kept hidden from the public. The folks of the small town speak of a darker secret concerning Sarah Bellows. That of children possibly being poisoned by the young woman.
You see, listeners, as the legend goes, around 100 years ago, the children of Mill Valley, possibly hoping to get a glimpse of Sarah, would come to the Bellows' home from her room, and if we are being completely honest here, it would be better to describe it as a prison. Sarah would entertain these secret visitors as they came to her in the night, telling them stories. Scary stories by way through an outer wall of the home.
Which is rather heartbreaking to think of. This young woman's only contact with the outside world is whispered tales of terror through a break in her bedroom wall.
Totally agreed, projectionist. The problem is, like I said, children started getting sick and dying. And as you might imagine, the townsfolk are quite upset about all of this. And, as Stella explains to Ramon, before the mob of angry parents could storm the Bellows residence, Sarah had hung herself using her own hair. It's some wonderful flavoring to the backstory. After all, I'm pretty sure growing up we all heard about that one place in town. The abandoned home that housed a woman with no face, or
perhaps a haunted dairy barn, such as when you were growing up.
Yes, even a haunted dairy barn. My friends, in case you aren't aware of what my co-host is referring to, on a Retroist Halloween special, the second special back in 2010, if I remember correctly, I shared my memory of hearing of a spectral bovine in my neck of the woods. Anyway, the Bellows home has long since been boarded up, especially in later years when children who would go to investigate the place never returned home. Although this dips its toe into spoiler territory, while the teenagers are checking the place out, it is Chuck who first comes to find out that things aren't exactly kosher in the Bellows house. Although it is Stella and Ramon who end up discovering something dark and lost, hidden away in the home, Sarah Bellows' bedroom. And it's there they find a book of Sarah Bellows' stories.
That appears to be inked in blood.
Oh, I definitely think it's written in blood. And Sarah's blood, I would add. This tome, of which we can plainly see there are more on the shelf...
Stories for future films, I would wager, Sage.
Possibly. It is Stella who inadvertently causes tragedy for her friends and Mill Valley. Taking the book awakens something. Something that is angry and extremely vengeful. Which is the setup for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Stella quickly realizes what she has done, and has to try and keep her friends alive long enough to figure out what they can do about it. You see, now they've caught the attention of Sarah Bellows. Stella, and Ramon in particular, have to watch in horror as new stories are written in blood. Ones with familiar names for fans of the book series, but these scary stories feature people that the teenagers know and love, as the protagonists of these particular tales. In addition, no matter what the friends attempt, there appears to be no way to destroy the book, or even the pages itself. Ripping them out by the handful reveals just another page, and the writing can't be halted. As Stella says in the trailer, you don't read the book, it reads you. Taking your nightmares and fears and using it against you. And make no mistake about it, people you will like in this movie do not always make it out alive. It is a horror movie after all. The screenplay for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark was courtesy of Dan and Kevin Hegman. The duo also wrote for Guillermo's Trollhunter animated series on Netflix, as well as the Lego movie, to point out a few of their works. Guillermo also worked on the screenplay from a story by both Marcus Dunstan and Patrick Melton. The stories that are adapted from the original source material of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark include The Red Spot, which came from Scary Stories 3, More Tales to Chill Your Bones, and focuses on a young girl with a disturbing blemish on her cheek. Also from that volume, and featured prominently on the theatrical poster for the film, is Harold, the Scarecrow, who in the film is played by Mark Steger, the Demogorgon of Stranger Things fame.
A much put upon Scarecrow that through the wrath of Sarah Bellows has his revenge against his abuser.
It should be pointed out that these adaptations are just that, as things occur differently in the film version encounter with Harold than in the original story. For example, it doesn't end with someone being skinned alive, which is not only understandable since it's a PG-13 film, but I would counter, the fate of the one that abuses him is just as disturbing. Let me take a moment and say that just the other day, I picked up Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, the haunted notebook of Sarah Bellows. It actually is a novelization of sort from the film, letting you read what was written down in the book in the film, as well as letting us see some production artwork from the movie. And the reason I brought it up is there is production art that shows at least at one point in the film that skinning scene took place. Mitai Doty Walker from the first Scary Stories volume is included in the film, at least elements of it. And yet again, I'm pushing against the boundary of spoiler territory. When you watch the film, pay very close attention to the dog in the scene. We've screened Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark in the Vault twice now, since it's released on August 9th, and both times, the projectionist and myself were amazed that some of the audience always missed a nod to the original story, in regards to the dog. The twisted nightmare of a man that Ramon in the trailer identifies as the Jangly Man is played by contortionist Troy James, who you might have seen as the Sleepwalker in 2016's The Void, or Pretzel Jack from Channel Zero, or even as Baba Yaga in 2019's Hellboy. Which, I might add that Troy's turn as that bit of Slavic folklore was terrifying to say the least.
Ha! Folklore indeed! You best hope we never have to contend with the Baba Yaga, boy!
Well, Troy, as the jangly man, is just as equally terrifying as he was as the Baba Yaga. The big toe is also featured in the film, although the putrid and shambling corpse that comes searching for who took her digit is based off that image of the woman I mentioned earlier, which came from the story The Haunted House, although that too gets a nod in the film, even if the particulars of that tale are altered slightly. Javier Botet plays the vengeful corpse with a missing toe. Javier played the disease-ridden nightmare hobo in 2017's It, and the god Set from that year's The Mummy. The Big Toe, by the way, was published in the original volume of Schwartz and Gammel's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. The last story, the one that unnerved me the most, friends, came from the third volume of the book series, from a story entitled The Dream. The truly nightmarish character, however, is known as the Pale Lady, a black-eyed and rather large entity, definitely female and equally innocent and yet giving off the impression of a great white shark, slowly and surely moving in for the kill. The Big Toe probably gave me the biggest jump of the entire film. It was the Pale Lady, who was also played by Mark Steger, that really made me slump down in my seat the two times I've seen the film.
Dear listeners, Victor jumped more than just a few times.
Hey, like I've already said, I have no problems admitting that I was affected by Andre's wonderful jump scares, projectionist. I think we've basically given an overview of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, listeners. It is a delightful treat, especially if you're one of the legion of fans of the source material. Yet again, the focus is on the teenagers, not so much the horror, although that obviously becomes more and more prevalent as the film continues. The filmmakers have also crafted a story I believe that is special in that we see the characters grow. Grow up, perhaps I should clarify. There is a real effort by the filmmakers to show that some of the characters have to accept a responsibility, not just for their actions in the film, but without trying to give anything away, there is a very sobering choice for one of them, an all-too-real horror of the time, and I'll say that it is perhaps even scarier than what Sarah Bellows could come up with, especially as we grow to like that character in question. Now, if I do have one nit to pick...
Here we go, dear listeners.
Bear with me, projectionist. In some of the reviews, I've noticed that folks feel that the characters of Augie and Chuck and Ruth are little more than fodder for Sarah Bellows' stories. That's not a spoiler, of course, as everyone in the movie is pretty much affected by that tome of scary stories. I will sort of agree that it would have been nice to learn a little more about Ruth, Augie, and Chuck, but I will counter there is far more backstory than you might think, especially if you're paying very close attention to what is being said by these characters, as well as their time in the spotlight, so to speak. Having said that, I do wish the movie was just a little bit longer. And, judging by the trailers, there appears to be more that didn't make it into the film itself. If you enjoy nice, creepy ghost stories with playful and memorable jump scares, you should go out and catch Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark in the theaters, my friends. It is worthy of your viewing time. Do you have anything to add, projectionist?
No, I feel you've bored our patient listeners far too much as it is.
Man, sometimes you make me wish I could find Sarah Bellows' book. I'd like to see how you fare.
What was that?
I was just saying I want to thank everyone for taking the time to listen to this Saturday Frights podcast matinee episode for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. We know you have a busy schedule, and the projectionist and myself always appreciate it when you take the time to visit with us. Now, before we end the show, there are some changes coming up for not just the Saturday Frights podcast, but for all the shows I have a hand in producing. The reason being is that for the last 10 years, I have graciously been given a space on the Retroist. I've never had to pay a dime in hosting fees for any of the shows. If you are a frequent visitor to the Retroist, you know that he has decided to do something different with the site, to reinvent it, to make it more personal. Like when he started it over a decade ago. Mainly, the Retroist will feature articles written by the Retroist and only him, although there might be a guest article now and again as I understand it. The Retroist is being kind enough to help me start up my own website to host the podcasts I produce and write for. And hopefully I'll have past Retroist authors join me there if they so wish. I mention all of this because there may come a point in the next couple of weeks that while new shows are being produced and released, they might not be showing up on iTunes and so on. I'll be sure to provide clear links to the Internet Archive when this takes effect, so just make sure that you are following me on Facebook and Twitter. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. If you have musical needs, you can contact him at peachy@retrowest.com. My co-host, The Projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He shares old movie posters and trivia and even newspaper clippings throughout the week. It's always neat to see what vintage thing he can dig up to share. As for myself, you can find me posting a couple times a day on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page too. I even managed to find time to share some things on the RetroWest Clubhouse on Facebook now and again. Saturday Frights has an Instagram account, by the way. If you want to check it out, you can find it. It's simply Saturday_Frights. If you'd like to contact me personally with suggestions for future episodes, you can reach me at VicSage@RetroWest.com. And friends, if you like the show, consider subscribing and giving us a rating over on iTunes or Stitcher and Spotify to help spread the word. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself, not just for hosting this podcast, but for allowing us to nearly 10 years share our love of all things retro. If you want to read the best collection of retro-related articles and listen to some of the best retro-related podcasts, hop on over to theretroist.com. Now then, let's listen to a clip from the subject of our next show.
It all began as a summer vacation. A young family found a beautiful old house. It had secluded, spacious grounds, a large swimming pool, magnificent furnishings.
So you are the people who want to rent this house?
What do you mean it's $900? And then it's all out.
Well, there is one other thing.
It's hardly a catch.
They thought it was the answer to their dreams, but it was the beginning of a nightmare.
This has been a Retroist production. Sleep well and goodbye.